we see? Do we have to go down there?
No idea.
We gotta go. He has to go down further. And we're gonna have to get. I think we're gonna. Can you see any of that? Can you see that it's?
You see the structure?
Any of the structure? Here. And are we in the way sitting on these benches?
We have to restart.
Well,
I'm just gonna go right here.
I think the doorway is enough. I can also capture the environment.
Okay.
Am I in the way?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'm facing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm gonna go low. Hold on. Alright. I'm rolling, and I think the audio is rolling. I'll double check.
Yep.
Okay.
So, Cecil, where are you?
I'm at St. Mary's Piscataway Church, Catholic Church, in the southern part of Prince George's County, Maryland. This is the what they call the old church, the original church. I went to school here for 8 years. First and eighth grade, 1976 to 1984. This is the old church. And across the way there, the building of the new church and the new foundation.
What can you tell us about the history of this church?
From what I remember about the church, it was supposed to be one of the first places where blacks, whites, and Native Americans could worship together. Remember the mural that's in the new church? The Piscataway tribe was baptized Catholic. So this area has pretty much always been a melting pot, ethnically, culturally, historically. The wood, those trees over there, used to be part of a big river. They used to be large enough for you to have, for ships to come up. There used to be a lot of trading there, according to church history. So that's pretty much all I know. More recently, the demographics of the church have changed a little bit. Now we have a large, very large Asian population in this church, probably in the Archdiocese of Washington in general, because the church, me and my wife now, We don't go to this church, but the church we went to after here, St. Columba, they had a large Asian population as well.
Did you, when you grew up here, you understood yourself to be black or Native?
Well, when I grew up here, I understood myself to be black, period. I didn't understand anything about supposedly being Native until I got a summer job that was part of a treaty for black Indians through the, what they call the JTPA, back in 1985. That's when somebody came talking to me about being an Indian, Senator Freedman, and our people this, our people that. She was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Cherokee. And I thought she was out of her mind until I went home and asked my mother and my grandmother about it. And they said, well, no, that's not true. Your great-grandmother is one quarter Piscataway. So yes, it's true. And then I wanted to find out, because back then, I don't know if you still can now, but back then, if you could prove Native American lineage, you didn't have to pay state tuition for college, but you had to be 1/16. And if that were the case, I still would have missed the mark, because math, I would have been 1/32. That's not enough to qualify.
So. Did your grandmother, your great-grandmother, you told us the story of your great-grandmother telling you, tell them the story about your great-grandmother and the hair.
Oh. I thought it was a perm. She had really straight hair, long black hair. And I just said one time, I said, man, you got a really good perm. She just rolled her eyes and said, this boy is so stupid. Just stop. And then when I found out, I was like, oh, she's Indian? She's an Indian? She's like, yes. You didn't know that your great-grandmother was an Indian? I said, no. Why do you think she has straight hair? I said, I thought she had a perm. I thought she had a perm. And I just thought some black people's hair just wasn't coarse. Because I remember my mother had to be careful who she would let do her hair perm her hair because they would just assume that it was harsher than it was. And I remember she said her hair fell out. And I remember her saying she cut her hair to fit in. I didn't really understand what that meant, but now I guess I do. So her hair was actually soft. Very, very soft to touch. So was her mother's hair. They both cut their hair short, and they said they had to be careful who they would let perm or process their hair because they put too much chemical in it and they break off. And now my father's mother, she's probably, if she's from Scataway, it's much, much more, because she used to sell her hair for wigs when she was young. And her joke was, I sold my hair for wigs, and then when I got old, I had to buy it back. That was her joke that she used to make all the time. But I just thought that it was just different types of black people. I didn't think that it meant anything, you know, in terms of being mixed with whatever. That some people were just light-skinned black people. I didn't really think that they were quote-unquote Piscataway, but a lot of them actually were both. And the more and more research that I, you know, just did on my own because I'm interested in the topic, a lot of the people that ended up claiming the Piscataway lineage have heavy concentrations of African DNA because they integrated in with the slaves. And some of the books I read about black Indians, like especially Cass's Black Indians, it can be hard to differentiate or delineate who's African, who's Indian, who's African and Indian, because there was a lot of intermarriage in between the Native American population and the African population. So you have people that were both, and remember in Cass's book, he said there's a lot of stories of, if there were some slaves that would escape, or just black people that just wanted to get away from the colonizers, they could go hide out with their Indian cousins, and if they put on a headdress, you couldn't tell who was who. And depending on whose version of history you believe, there's already people here on what they call Turtle Island, which is supposed to be the name for North America. There's already black people here. What we think of as black people, what I think of as a black person, is already here. And interesting enough, too, if you start thinking about or talking about straight genetics and straight DNA markers, I've read, and I don't know how true this is, I've read that some of the people that we would call actual Native Americans, some of them actually have Norwegian or European DNA in them anyway, and this was the indigenous of this continent. So, and there's a lot of untested regions in the country, so it's hard to really try to say what the true cutoff is if you want to just look at DNA. The cutoff is going to have to be your culture and how you appear, if you want to say how it functions. Because to me, who got to be an Indian, or who got to be a Piscataway, or who gets to be black, who gets to be white, is based on what they see when they look at you. That's what it is. It's like, if you want to go by the one drop rule, then I'm Southeast Asian. Do you think that in my ancestry DNA results, there are Southeast Asian people that pop up that it says, this is your fourth cousin? I'm like, that can't be my fourth cousin. This is your fourth cousin. This is your fifth cousin. This is your eighth. That can't be my eighth cousin. Yes, it is. But do you think that if I met that person on the street that I would be welcome as family necessarily? No. I would be a stranger, because people are just going to go by what they see. And that's how come. And I warned my wife. I said, look, our babies can come out looking any kind of way in my family. When I was born, I looked Chinese. And then I got darker. Our daughter looked like that too. She was really, really fair. We were like, this is your child. I was like, that's not my baby. It's like, this is my side of the family. That's my daughter. She's going to get darker. And she got darker. You wouldn't know it by just looking at the baby.
How about the nurse when she found out I was the mother?
Yeah, the nurse jumped. See, my birth certificate, I guess I'm one of the last Negroes. My birth certificate says Negro. It does not say black. I don't know if you've ever heard of Neely Fuller Jr. He wrote the United Independent Compensatory Code System Context, a textbook workbook for victims of racism and white supremacy. People call it a code for short. I read his book and I've listened to some of his talks because he's very, very old. And I used to work with him at a summer job. I didn't know he was that brilliant, right? But he said that Negro means mixed race. That's one of the things he came up with. That just kind of stuck with me. Negro means mixed race. All these racial delineations, the people that I call like the true hardcore racists or racial connoisseurs, they know. They know all this stuff. There are people, and I used to think people used to be telling me some of this stuff just to manipulate me or to try to bond with me. There are people that could look at me and they knew exactly whatever it was that I was mixed with. They've been telling me this stuff. People from whatever African country has shown up in my DNA, somebody from that country has come to me at some point and say, you have some of our blood in it. And I didn't care because I'm American and you're not gonna treat me differently or try to act like I'm a special black man because I got some of your blood. How you treat the other black people that's walking around? That's always been my thing. So whatever, like you're Irish, that's showing up. We got a picture from one of our ancestors. It was a black Confederate soldier that married an Irish white woman in one of my branches that feeds into my tree. That's as far back as my cousin Ricky traced that part of the family, Mr. Hemp. So that shows up in me. People that really know about, that really are serious about studying race, they know all that. They know exactly where people show up, just like the people knew before I did, the older people knew this guy qualifies to be in this program so he can satisfy this treaty as a so-called black Indian. I didn't know that because functionally speaking, I'm black. That's it. That's what matters. Now, where I think people should know this stuff though, because whatever race is in your DNA strain, you get their diseases when you get older. That's how gout shows up in my family. Somebody remember this Irish dude at work, I'm not gonna say his name. He saw me taking some allopurinol. He's like, what are you doing taking that? Like, I'm not allowed to take this. Like, well, they say I'm at risk of gout, have kidney disease. Like, that's an Irish thing. It's like, well, a lot of people in my family have gout. So I'm old enough now, I live long enough, congratulations, I have to take this, so I can be helpful. But it's stuff like that. Those type of things are gonna show up in your DNA, so that's one reason why it's good to know what your genetics are, so you can at least know what type of diseases you may be predisposed to. Because all that stuff shows up.
When we were walking, and we were walking, and this is your family cemetery, right?
Well, some of my family is buried over here because a lot of my family went to this church. We got people here. There's St. Joseph's Church down in the next county that's got a lot of my relatives on my father's side. And so, but there's a plot over there that's got quite a few of my ancestors over there.
So, what I was saying is that many of the people that you identified here,
Medleys.
When you went to school with them here?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us something about them? And their old families here in Washington. I mean, Southern
Are you talking about the whole thing with the Proctors, Harleys, Thompsons, Swans? Proctors, Harleys, Thompsons, Swans,
Marshalls.
Butlers, Newmans, Marshalls. Well, I don't think the Washingtons get to be in that film because we're darker.
But you're all, but you're
all
listed
them,
as full black.
Yeah. As far as I know, the people who at one point were called, it's a pejorative now, I believe, I don't want to use the term, called we sorts, were saying we're sort of black, we're sort of white, we're sort of Native American. So we are our own group, a mixed group, and I think that's who makes up the bulk of what's considered the Piscataway tribe in Maryland, especially in this region of Maryland. What do they call that? I think they called it, because there's another book I read about it. I think they call them tri-racial. Thank you. Thank you for the term. Tri-racial isolates. So the genetics are a mixture of black, white, and Native American, Indian. But functionally speaking, you don't really get to be tri-racial if you don't look tri-racial. It's functionally whatever you look like, whatever you look at. So, because somebody's asked, people asked me before, are you a wee sort? I'm like, no, I'm not a wee sort, I'm black. But don't you come from that area? Yes, but everybody that comes from that area is not necessarily in that group. That's why I was saying, I mean, to me, it was just because people would try to say, well, you know, we're Indian this, and then we're Indian that, and, you know, well, some people are part white and all this other stuff. You'll have people splitting off where, okay, whoever's closer to white is kind of ostracized from people who's closer to black. But then let a white person call somebody the N-word and everybody's ready to talk a T-bill. But in terms of the groups, especially if you look on Wikipedia, the groups that are considered to be, the family names that are considered to be in the tri-racial isolates. Let me see if I can get it right because I always forget them all. It's the Proctor, that's the main group that's known. That's known for like burying their relatives in order to keep the gene line pure. That's what they're known for historically. I really don't think it's the case anymore, but that's what they were known for historically. Proctors, Thompsons, Swans, Harleys, Newmans, Savoys, Butlers, Marshalls, and who else? The Medleys,
and the Washingtons, are they the next
we,
year down?
Probably, because I know we have, let's say we have some relatives, either by people marrying back and forth between those families, we have some relatives, like some of my relatives have married Crockers, some of my relatives have married Butlers, which means then in turn some of my relatives are Butlers, but I'm not closely related to them, a lot of Washingtons aren't closely related to them. But some of our relatives have married back and forth into those families. Like one thing I've noticed, even if these families don't marry each other, I notice from generation to generation, the same groups of families will hang out and the kids seem to find each other. Like my son has managed to find children of people I went to high school with. When he was in high school, they just gravitate right towards each other. My daughter too. Our families tend to hang around with people that are Thompsons, the Marshalls, and Butlers, because we kin to some of the Butlers. It may be like third, fourth, or fifth cousin. My grandmother told me, maternal grandmother told me she used to hang around with a Proctor. But she said she was the darkest person, and the Proctor woman was the lightest person. They were both ostracized because you know how people are. You must conform to the middle. So they gravitated towards each other, but by then they were fourth cousins. So if I were to be related to them, I'd be fifth, sixth, seventh cousin. It'd be starting to be distant. And we lost touch with them. So that's the thing with me. It's a lot of people, because I'm the youngest of four, and just because people started getting old by the time I came around, I started losing the energy to take me around to a lot of stuff. There are a lot of people who don't even know I exist. They don't even know that my father has two sons. And especially if they're a lot older than me, because I'm 51 at the time of this video, they still think I'm 4 or something. He's got kids? Like, yeah. We've got people, we've got relatives right across the bridge, going south into Virginia. I know they're there because I went there, but I don't know how to find them anymore. At Tucker Road Community Center, there are some old houses there. There may still be people living in them. Those are my family, but I've lost touch with them. If there's still some of the original line there, I can't knock on their door. I don't know. I probably don't know anybody who to introduce them to. One thing I did to remedy that, that has helped, is I named my son after my grandfather, Raymond Washington. And that's helped him get back in touch with a lot of older people, because when they say his name, when he says his name, they ask, are you, then they start asking, are you related to him? And then he can say yes. Or another thing, since we recycle names so much in our family, and I was at the Ramada Inn one time. Why were we at the Ramada? I can't remember why we were at the Ramada.
Were we having a party for my mother?
Yeah.
60th birthday party.
And Raymond was running across the lobby. And I said, Raymond Washington, get over here. And these two older people turned around. And their vibe felt very familiar. They looked like they could be my relatives. And they came over and started talking. They asked me questions. They said, you've got relatives out in California. You probably don't know them. It's like, no, I don't know my relatives out in California. But they said there were some people here, and most likely for work, they just started spreading out all over the country, just trying to survive. I've lost touch with them.
You're gonna do that, okay? So, can you feel when you're in the city, like as you move from Southern Maryland closer to DC, can you feel the influence of that Southern
as I'm working? Not necessarily. I feel like the closer you get to the city, the thinner the culture becomes. It's almost like the buildings choke the vibration out. But what I have been able to do, I did this on this 2 jobs ago now. I can find people from down there. I can find them. I know them. I just know who they, it's like Highlander. I can pick them out and I find them and we start talking. And I find a lot of people now that are there are people who are moving up to there from the south, from like Carolina. And that's how I can keep up with what's going on down there. I just ask them what's going on, what's the places to eat now, what's the places to go to, and they'll tell me. So I can find them. Now, interestingly enough, it depends on how they feel. If they're proud of where they're from, it's great. If they're trying to escape their rural roots, they hate my guts. So there has been some of that.
Okay, also more direct. Can you think of examples of physical, what we call material culture, okay? Things that we look for, food ways, what traditions did you have here that you think have been maintained? And physical material culture, like we talk about sewing. What traditions did you grow up with, or did you witness, I'm talking about the farmer, did you think was survived and entered into urban suburban life?
The tradition of, we have some people that make their own alcohol and their own liquor. Yes. Not just moonshine. You have moonshine, which is the corn liquor. But you also can have homemade wine if you take fruit, sugar, and water, let it ferment over time, and it can create some of the most delicious wine ever known to man. I know there's some people that are doing that. It's been some places, like when I was doing music in D.C., there's some guys sitting on the car that was selling moonshine. There's still people that'll do things like that, selling moonshine. I don't see it too much now after the pandemic, but before. Now, if you want to talk about going to the city, if you go up 201 probably about every quarter mile to a mile, there's a little barbecue stand where you can get some genuine, really, really good barbecue. I couldn't get Audrey to eat out a lot of those places because she just swore we were going to die of food poisoning. I said the risk is what makes it taste good.
What kind of things would they eat?
A lot of food we had was any and every part of the pig. A lot of
dishes.
Yes. Ham, ribs, scrapple, what do they call that? Fat back, bacon. Some people would eat what they call the mountain oysters. I never ate those, which are the pig testicles. I never ate that. Chitterlings, AKA chitlins. Pig ears, pig snout, pig tail. I've only had it a couple of times because for some reason they said children aren't supposed to eat it. I don't know if that's true or if they just want it for themselves, but the pig brain, it could be because it could be a parasite in there or something that you can't, that a child can't process when an adult can. Mixing that in with eggs, pig brain, like you were saying, souse, and that's something the Caribbeans eat too, souse. In terms of rice, it was just white rice. It wasn't necessarily the red beans and rice that you see Caribbeans eat. Cornbread, sweet potatoes, mashed potatoes, black-eyed peas, spinach, kale, watercress. That's about anything you can think of. French toast with cheese, without cheese. Potato salad, all manners of barbecue, both beef and pork. Barbecue ribs, beef and pork, barbecue chicken. That's more barbecue, of course, more in the summer. Coleslaw. People that like to fish had all manners of fish, fried, baked, broiled. A lot of catfish, cod. Salmon is not really, that seems kind of like, that's more from the store. But anything that you would catch in the water around here and capture and eat. No, I didn't know anybody that ate eel, but there were people that ate, you know, they would eat the game, they'd hunt around here. I mean, I've had deer, squirrel, rabbit, I've had frogs, but that was from the restaurant, frog legs. So I've had deer, rabbit, and squirrel, possum. I ain't like possum, it's kind of gamey to me. Muskrat. I've had muskrat. Just different relatives have had it. If you go to their house, if they wanted to save some money and it was in season, they'd shoot it and eat it. But you know, I think people started looking down on that type of thing. Well, one, it was two things. It's, I know people started looking down on it because I guess they felt like, oh, that's too country, that's not sophisticated. We should eat from the store like everyone else does. And we can afford it now, so we're gonna go buy the government's testosterone-filled, hormone-laced meat that's making people act like they're losing their minds and giving them cancer. So they probably felt like that was better. But there's also a thing of, there's so much pollution in the environment, some of this stuff I wouldn't trust to eat even if I knew how to kill it anyway. Because it's too close to where the highway is. You hear all these cars. Unless I had to, I wouldn't eat any of this stuff that's killed here because it's probably got pollution in it. That's another thing you have to take into consideration too. Like the fish, some of the fish in some of these places, there's still people fishing. I wouldn't eat that stuff because it's probably polluted. Because you don't know what's in there. You can't guarantee that the EPA is really cracking down on these people to keep the environment clean.
To
the city? None of it. It's like the city just cuts it off. Once you start getting to the city, it just chops. And everybody's just eating whatever is in the store. One thing that really baffles me, but I gotta remember, this is how they came up. You know the term, like people say there are food deserts. People say that there are, I don't know if they call it vegetable deserts, but they're saying there are parts of the city that you can't get a vegetable. You can't get vegetables. That sounds crazy to me. But I guess if there's nobody around there that's growing it, if they don't ship it to that part of the city, they're not going to get it. they're not going to have vegetables. They're going to have to learn how to grow their own gardens if they really want to have that in there.
Did your people know how to forage, like if they were in an environment, like an urban environment, they said there's no food. Did your people know what to do? Your mother's family, grandmother's family, they would never be on.
I think the older people would. I don't think that too many people in my generation would know how to do that. And I definitely don't think that my children would know how to do that because they didn't have to. And it's just something that was passed on like it should have been, in my opinion. If it were up to me, it would be mandatory in school that everybody would have to learn how to hunt, fish, trap, and grow stuff in case the grid goes down. Because there's food all around us and we don't know how to eat it. I was in the Boy Scouts for a little bit too. Maybe that's why I think like that. But like stuff about how to purify water, that's something I read in the book. I don't know how to do it. That's something I think everybody should know how to do.
What did they do with the lime water that you had?
They started shutting, if they shut a lot of those wells down, I've seen people knocking their pumps down and just covering up because they want to be modern, so they think it's okay to go with the modern water system.
Did they disinfect the water?
No, we got water out of the ground. They said that because water was so deep in the ground, it was considered to be purified. I think of something with the clay cleans it out, something like that. I don't know how true that is. But the water is already purified because it's too deep in the ground for the pollutants to get to it. Yet, every time there was an explosion at the base, people would come in their CDC suits. We'd be quarantined. I didn't even know I was being quarantined until years later. I saw an episode of the X-Files, and I'm like, oh my God, those are the suits. I was in a quarantine, that's why I couldn't go to school. They come and test the water, test the environment, and make sure that we were okay, and we were cleared to go. But you just took the water out of the ground because it was clean. Now, the water that was not clean, which of course I got in trouble for trying to drink as a child, because I ain't no better. If it's running on the surface of the ground, like in a creek, you couldn't drink it. I think my grandmother said, my mother's mother, actually both of them said this. I think after the space shuttle went up in the air, that's when a lot of them started thinking that you can't drink the water off the ground anymore. They just assumed they destroyed the sky when they launched the space shuttle, so the water's unclean. It's got to come from out of the ground now, not flowing on the ground. Because they said they used to just go down with a bucket, get water out of the ground, like you're doing some foreign countries in the rural areas, just take the water out of the ground, walk it back, pour it, maybe boil it, and drink it. Or set it out in the sun in a bottle to purify it and just drink it. You can't do that now. I wouldn't drink the water flowing in the ground near my house now. Are you crazy? I wouldn't drink that. Not unless there really was nothing else. Remember a lot about that because I was a boy, so it was like, who cares? One of my sisters still crochets, so she's probably gonna tell you more about that. She crochets some stuff. My grandmother made a couple of blankets. I know some of the dresses that they had were like made, homemade or modified, but of course, the only thing I learned how to do was just thread a needle and sew up some holes and some stuff. That's all I can tell you. I can't really help you with that. Because I was a boy. Boys don't do that. Right?
Were you given a knife?
No, I wasn't given a knife. I found one, though.
And, were you taught how to shoot?
I was taught how to shoot by my sister's boyfriend. But my mother didn't want me to learn how to shoot a BB gun because she was afraid that I would get shot by a cop or by a hunter or by a racist. So when I came along, no, you're not learning how to shoot, it's too dangerous. They're gonna make up an excuse to shoot you. And I said, oh. But I still learned how to shoot anyway from my sister. Boyfriend, my nephew's father. Learned how to shoot the shotgun. And when I got in the military was when I learned how to shoot a proper handgun.
I do. So, knives and guns for hunting and survival,
mm-hmm.
right? But what about in regard to building or crafting? Did anybody carve? Did anybody...
As far as carving, no, not really. I mean, I used to carve some artwork with the knife myself when I was little and make pictures.
Mm-hmm.
None of that survived because I didn't think to keep track of it. I didn't think it would be worthwhile or anything. So none of us did carving. But what's interesting is, this is going to sound weird, I did not think that guns were used for people. I thought that guns were used on animals and for hunting. Like if you were attacked by an animal, you would shoot the animal. I didn't think that guns were used for people until I was about 12 years old and I saw two people get in an argument and one person, or of course, like if it was in the war, like you know, on TV, that they used guns. I didn't think that regular people used guns on each other until I saw two people get in an argument. I'm not saying who they are on purpose. But one was from the city and one was from down there. And the city guy went and got a gun, a pistol. And I was like, why is he getting a gun? Because there are no dogs out here. Nobody's hunting. He's mad. He's going to shoot him with a gun? I was 12 years old. I'm pretty sure there are 12-year-olds and 6-year-olds, for that matter, that know that you can take a gun and shoot somebody. But because that's how I came up. I was taught I wasn't allowed to touch the gun because I wasn't large enough. They said if I tried to hold the gun, then the gun would be holding me, basically. And I think that's true. Because I saw something online where somebody was trying to show like a 6-year-old girl how to shoot a gun. It was too big for her. It went off and she ended up killing her father. So then you gotta be strong enough to hold it. You gotta get a weapon that's calibrated for the child. So that was when I first learned that a gun was for people, too. I thought it was just for animals or for hunting.
Well, I don't think the gun really is for people in the way that we see. This is a deviation. What we're witnessing now is a horrific deviation. And, you know, from survival.
Well, yeah, because...
You know, so...
Because more to that point, there was something I was watching where they said that... we're the only species that fights each other with weapons that are lethal. Like, for example, some of the animals like that butt each other, deers, when they fight things outside of their species, they'll use their horns and their lethal parts. When they fight each other, they may push or butt heads, but they don't try to gore each other to death. But people do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have made a lot of connections, you know, connections to the land, connections to legacy, connections to history in a way that really brings us home, because that's why we're here. We're here in Piscataway, in the land of Piscataway, at Piscataway Catholic Church, trying to find out what it means to be Black in the land of Piscataway, and trying to figure out how that connects with the arts sector, and trying to figure out how that connects to Baltimore in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that we are looking for. And your voice, your words have been really, really helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. There's got to be some cross-pollination, because how do they say dog in Baltimore? No. How do they say dog in Baltimore?
I don't say dog like that, and I was born and raised in Baltimore.
She knows what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. Everything there, I mean, every place has a way of using language.
Mm-hmm.
Every place has a way of using language, and there are a few areas in Baltimore that misuse language in such a way. I was brought up by educators,
uh-huh.
and, you know, they, but there's a way that people talk in Southern Maryland. There's a way that people talk in the Eastern Shore. There's a way that people talk in the Eastern Shore. But it connects very much to the Great Migration and where your people are coming from, coming up out of the South and coming out of emancipation. This is Juneteenth, so coming into, we're coming up on Juneteenth. And it is about where people were enslaved,
mm-hmm.
how people were required to behave during slavery,
mm-hmm.
and what that legacy, how much education was withheld from people, how people had to talk to keep their families safe. And then it also connects to that migration trail, that great migration trail, and where you're coming from. So people in South DC talk a certain way because they've come from a certain place. People in Baltimore talk a certain way because they've come from a certain way. And so that just gets really back to what we're doing. It is really about understanding the history and the legacy so that we can honor properly who has lifted us up and why we are even surviving, and we can honor properly those that have been diminished or lost their lives so that we can live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what all this is about. It's like how we can shine now isn't just because we decided to shine. It's because a whole lot of people put in hundreds and hundreds of years of work and agony so that we could be here.
Mm-hmm.
And did things like be maids and porters and all of those things, even though we are people who are the genius that built the land.
Mm-hmm.
We are the people who were trafficked and kidnapped because of our intelligence, our legacy, our history, all of those things. And it is too easy to diminish it to, these people talk this way and it's funny. But it's not that, it's never that. It's always so much bigger than that and almost always so much more important than that. The other thing that happens over and over again is that while melanated people are doing the joke, the other people who are calling themselves allies are lifting up and appropriating the history and the legacy, and they're saying, oh, well, we want to honor the land, and oh, we want to honor this, and oh, we want to, so they can rewrite the story like that mural
mm-hmm.
over there and say it's because of us that everybody is
mm-hmm.
is anything. And so this is just an opportunity. You were part of the opportunity to unpack the confusion and to shine a light where it needs to be. I thank you. I thank you for your energy, your effort, your family history, for what your personal memories. I thank you, because that's what it's about, you know.
What does it mean to you to be black and alive?
I never really thought about it.
Remember the story you told me about when you first realized you were black? Like the people on the street that they called you?
Oh! Well, that wasn't really... You talking about when they called me Smibba?
Well, that was me.
Oh, what?
When the guys were driving by.
Oh, yeah. Alright, so... I was about 10 years old. We were coming back from the county fair. So this is in Charles County. It's me and my friend, who's probably also my cousin, Anthony, we're walking. And some white dude is driving, not paying attention where he's going. He almost runs us over. We jump out the way and he goes, says, "Watch where you're going, nigger!" Right? 10 years after that, after I met Audrey, I'm hanging out in Birchwood. I'm walking in Birchwood. It's a black dude driving now. He's not paying attention. He almost comes up on the sidewalk, almost runs me over. I jump out the way, and he said, "Watch where you going, nigga." So I'm just like, I'm still a nigga no matter where I'm at. It's just got a different accent. They say girl, they say God, they both hate me and don't even see me on the road because they just can't see a black person. And that's what's really dangerous. Based the racist spirit infecting people, even if the person looks like the person that they're targeting with the hate. Because they've been culturally conditioned and brainwashed. I've almost been run over several times in DC, and I swear, I think if I was white, they would have seen me. But they just don't think they need to see black people when they're driving or backing up. They don't even, they look, they see you, it doesn't register. So, you know,